May Hall, come right on in. This is Carol, my wife. Honey, why don't you stand up? She'll be speaking a little later. And we are just absolutely delighted to be here with you. We were asked by the Navigators a couple of years ago. We've been with the Navs for over 32 years. And in fact, when Doug was speaking this morning, I got to thinking about how am I going to start this morning. And I would like to have the liberty and the time to start the same way Doug did this morning and reminisce a little bit. Because I could take you back to Oregon days and Doug Coe and our time together. Doug, if he didn't mention it this morning, but is quite a competitor at anything he does, from mumbly pig to touch football and golf. And he and I have competed in all of those things, including mumbly pig. I can remember spending hours with him flipping that knife and competing with him for hundreds of dollars. That's how he financed the Navigator ministry back in those days. No, I'm kidding. But Doug did have a tremendous impact on our lives back in our early contacts with the Navigators when we were living in Portland, Oregon, and Doug and Jan were in Salem. And we would get together at least once a month with a group of guys there from around the state of Oregon and spend the whole day together in the Word and prayer and praying for various aspects of our ministries in the state of Oregon. And we haven't seen each other very much over the years since those days, but from time to time we have the opportunity to get together, and it's always just a delightful time. However, Doug, I want you to know I've been working on my golf game, and I'd like to get you out on the course one of these days soon. Let me just get a couple of little brief things out of the way before we really get started. You're looking at these things. If you didn't get one when you came in, there's plenty of them over here, and you can get one later. We're not going to be actually using them this morning because we don't have time. But let me explain what it is. In the normal course of events, Carol and I will spend a whole week on a marriage seminar. We'll start Friday night with a church or another group or something. Go all day Saturday and then sometimes Sunday morning if it's away at a conference grounds or something like that. And during the course of that time, as we discuss various topics related to marriage, we'll give little assignments out of these handouts. And the thing that we would like to have you do in the next few weeks is take these home with you and begin to use them. Maybe do one little project a week together as a husband and a wife. This is strictly a team effort. This is not something you can do by yourself. It's something that you as a husband and a wife do together. Now, you start out separately. For instance, turn to page 1 to understand each other. Each of you would take your sheet and you would spend 10, 15, 20 minutes by yourself and begin to work your way through these statements or questions and putting down your answers to them. Very specific answers, not vague generalities. List ways in which you and your spouse are alike, and then list ways in which you and your spouse are different, and then on down through. And then after you've completed this as a husband and as a wife, then get together and begin to talk your way through it. Share with each other what you have written down, and you will be absolutely amazed what kind of open doors that will do for you on discussing things in your marriage. Now, we're going to be talking about communication this morning, and there's a whole page. Page 2 is on communication. So there's several topics that you can do that on. Fill it out individually, then get together and talk your way through it. Then turn over to page 7. This is one of the most fun little projects in the whole handout. 12 ways that we are intimate in our relationship together as a husband and a wife. And the way you do this is, again, individually, you would go down through this list and you would analyze where you feel as a husband and where you feel as a wife, where you are in your relationship in each of these areas, found on a scale of 1 to 7, 1 being somewhat dissatisfied, 7 being very satisfied with that particular aspect of your relationship. And then after you've gone down through each of these, now you may get to one or two, you know, that are just not applicable to you. For instance, when Carol and I did it, number nine really wasn't that meaningful to us. We're not really that into aesthetic things. I mean, we enjoy beauty, but it's not a big deal with us. But when we got to recreation, that was something that really pricked our bubble, and we realized that we were not very close to one another on that. And so as a result of discussing this, we did it one day when we were taking a trip in a car all day. And we had filled it out ahead of time and knew what we had put, and then we took each item and just discussed it together most of the day in the car. We probably talked about it 5 or 6 hours. And we came up with recreation as being the thing we needed to work on the most. Now, we heard about one couple who got down to number 12, and he had a 7+ and she had a 2-. And obviously, they had something to talk about. So that's what this is for, is to open up doors of communication between the two of you. And then you get over to communication skills as a listener. How good a listener are you? Same thing. Fill it out separately, then get together and talk about it. Then the last section is a whole bunch of questions on various topics and subjects that this is primarily designed for engaged couples or newly married couples, this section right here, questions for better communication. However, it may be of help to some of you. But I would particularly encourage you to go through this, at least to familiarize yourself with it, because you're going to run into a friend who's getting married, a couple, or a newly married couple, and they're having some trouble with communication. Or maybe they're not having trouble with communication, but they want to work on it. Well, this is a way to do it. These are all questions that they can take one question at a time, ask it of one another, draw one another out, talk about it, talk their way through it, and learn a great deal about each other that they may never have known before, because there's stuff in here that most couples don't even think to talk about together. So that is that. You can take it home, use it however you want. We encourage you to go through it in the next few weeks. As I started to mention, a little over 2 years ago, the Navigators asked Carol and me to consider going full-time into this whole issue of marriage and the family. We've been doing a marriage seminar for, 20, 25 years, I guess, something like that. But it's always been a backstroke thing. It's been something that we've done on a weekend when I've had a weekend free with my other responsibilities with the Navigators. And we'd leave on a Friday afternoon, get back on a Sunday night, and then I'd go to work Monday morning. Well, 2 years ago, the Navs asked us to go at this full time, and we weren't sure whether it was the thing we really wanted to do or not. We prayed about it, talked about it, and finally felt that this was the thing that the Lord was leading us to do. And I hate to make a statement like this, but in all honesty, I have to. We are having more fun than we've ever had in our lives. And to think that I get paid for this is almost borders on the ridiculous, because we enjoy it so much. We get to travel half the time, and we love to travel, and both here in the United States as well as overseas. We leave early part of next month for 5 weeks in New Zealand, and much of that will be ministry. Part of it's going to be celebrating our 40th wedding anniversary. So, you know, you work in little things like that to make life enjoyable, huh? I'm sure all of you figured out how to do that. But anyway, here is a little brochure. Some of you, I noticed, picked them up. They're out here on the table. It tells about our ministry. And if we could be of service in any way to you and your community and your church through some group that you know of, this will tell you what we can do. Give us a call, write us a letter, and we will try and work something out with you. So, enough of that. Carrying on just a little bit from where Doug sort of left off this morning. If we're really going to make our marriages work, I mean, and to be rewarding and fulfilling to the extent that God wants them to be, there's no specific passage in the Scripture that tells us, this is what God expects of our marriage in detail. But there are numerous statements and phrases and paragraphs and short passages throughout the Scripture that give us some insight into what God has in store for us in this phenomenal thing that he invented called marriage, if we're willing to give him his rightful place. And that's absolutely vital. There is no way that we as Christians can make marriage really work 100% for us, find it rewarding, fulfilling, everything that God has for us, unless we give him his rightful place, both in our lives and in our marriage. So the thing that Doug was pointing out this morning, our whole purpose in life, to get to know him, to get close to him. Jeremiah 9:23 and 24 talks about that. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glory or boast in this, that he knows and understands me, that I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Now, this is a picture of marriage. It's a triangle, the right kind of triangle. The husband, the wife, and God. And folks, it is inevitable that the closer this husband gets to God, and the closer this wife gets to God, the closer they are going to get to one another. That's the key. That's the secret. That's where we start, right there. And of course, communication with God is an absolutely vital thing. We've got to spend time with him, alone, in his word, letting him speak to us, letting him communicate to us, and time alone with him in prayer, communicating to him. Some time ago, I came across a little statement written in one of the letters that I got from a NAV staff guy. And it's a statement by Eugene Nida, who is probably one of the outstanding linguists, evangelical linguists in the world, has given his whole life to this whole issue of communication. Here's what he said. First of all, he starts out and he says, communication is tricky. I agree with that. He says, no two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. That's one of the mistakes that we make in communication, not only in marriage, but with other people, is we make the mistake that thinking that meanings are in words, when most of the time meanings are in people. And that's what he means. But no two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. That's why it's important for us to make sure that we are digging out of that person what they mean rather than just what they said. Carol is going to be giving us a definition of communication as it relates to marriage in just a little while. Secondly, Dr. Nida says, no two words in any one language ever have exactly the same meaning. That even complicates it more. Thirdly, he says, no two words in any two languages ever have exactly the same meaning. Now, he says, communication is tricky, huh? Okay. That is verbal communication, though. Nonverbal is even more complex, he says. Every culture has its own unspoken language that is every bit as definite as the verbal. And we have that in the English language and in our culture here in the United States. We have movements, facial expressions, little gestures that have just as much meaning, if not more meaning, than the words we say. And we've got to learn what that means when our spouse does it, or what it doesn't mean. And then he says, he's talking about the ministry here, he says our ministry runs on communication. And as I thought about that, well, you know, to a great extent, our marriages run on communication, don't they? And if it's running good, our communication is good. Our marriage, if it's running good, our communication is usually good. If something is wrong in our marriage, usually if you get back to the real root cause, it's either a spiritual problem or a communication problem. I heard a story a number of years ago about a guy in the western suburbs of Chicago who had just recently retired. And as the days went by, he would get up in the morning. His wife would fix him breakfast, which was the normal procedure, had been for years. But then he would hang around the house, and he was there. He was always there. And as the days and the weeks went by, she was getting more sick and tired of him being around. And they kind of got in each other's way, and they didn't know how to handle the situation. And finally, after a couple of months, he saw the handwriting on the wall, and he was walking downtown, this little western suburb of Chicago, and he saw a little office and an old office building for rent. So he went and inquired, found out that it wasn't very much rental per month. It was just a little one-room office with an old glass, frosted glass panel on the door, you know, these old-fashioned type of things. And so he put down a month's rent in advance, went home, and moved over his desk and chair and his favorite easy chair, a coffee table, and a little end table, and a lamp, and his little portable TV on the table on it, set it on a table. And a couple days later, he moved into his office. And then every morning when he'd get up after breakfast was over, why, he'd say goodbye to his wife, and he'd go off to the office and spend the day there reading his favorite books or watching his favorite TV programs. And then he'd come home in the evening, and everything was going along okay. And also on that frosted window, he figured he had to have something there. So he put consultant. And things began to smooth out at home. Then one day, after he'd been in the office for, about 3 weeks, mid-morning, there was a knock on the door. He went to the door and answered it. There was an elderly gentleman standing there, and he said, "Can I help you?" And he says, "Yeah, I think so." He says, "Are you a consultant?" He says, "Yeah, I'm a consultant." He says, "What kind of consultant are you?" And he says, "Well, what kind do you need?" And he says, "Well, I've got this problem." He says, "Just recently I retired." And he repeated to this guy his own story. Oh, he needed to get out of the house. And so the guy listened, and he said, "Listen, I got an idea. Why don't you move in with me? There's plenty of room in this office for two of us. You go on home, you get your desk and chair and your easy chair. We can kind of trade off on the TV programs. We only need one television." And so he did, and they moved in, and everything went smoothly. The only thing they changed was they put an S after consultant. And now it was consultants. Now, that's a true story. That really happened. But the question is, why did it happen? Huh? Communication. In America today, the divorce rate among people past 50 or who have been married 25 years or more is rampant. It's epidemic in proportion to everything else that's going on. And the reason for that basically boils down to communication. See, what happens is we get married, and I have never met a newly married couple who really loved each other, who when you ask them what attracted them to one another, they wouldn't come out with some kind of a statement that was in the ballpark of something like this. "Oh, we can talk about anything together. He listens to me," or "She listens. She understands me." You know what I'm talking about. But then you talk to him 5 years later, and something has happened. The mystique has gone out of that. And then you talk to him 20 years later, and there's some things they can't even talk about anymore, or don't talk about. See, it's a gradual drip process. It isn't something that happens overnight. It's something that gradually, in the course of time, deteriorates between a husband and a wife if they don't constantly work at communicating with each other. Next to this matter of our getting to know God as a husband and a wife, getting to know and understand Him, communication between these two people is absolutely vital. It's the most important thing in marriage because it touches on every other aspect of our relationship. And so if we have not or are not developing good communication patterns between one another as a husband and a wife, it's going downhill. Not probably perceptible enough for us to see it unless we look back over a long time frame. And it's never too late to rebuild bridges. And that's why we're having this seminar today, is to be of some practical help to you in some way in this whole area of communication between you as a husband and a wife. Now, Carol's going to come up and sort of introduce us to this whole thing, but I want to say one thing to her before she comes, and that is, honey, I want you to take all the time you want. I know there's no way we can cover everything we want to today in the time frame they've given us, but what she has to say is so vital and so important, I don't want you to cut it short. And I'll tag along. She's sticking her tongue at me. Can you imagine that? So I'll tag along afterwards and pick up the pieces later.
Okay. What do you think that means?
I'll tell you what it means.
That's nonverbal communication.
Jim, whom we'd never met, met us at the Washington, D.C. airport and identified himself by holding up a book, a copy of our book, Marriage Takes More Than Love. As we got together and drove out to the suburb to pick up his wife to go to the conference grounds, we all got in the car. And Jim's wife turned to us in the back seat and she said, "How'd y'all meet?" Well, that's one of our very favorite questions, not only to ask people, but to answer. But fortunately, this time, Jack chose to answer and give her the short version. And he said, "We met at college." She looked flustered, flushed, embarrassed, and then she turned to us and said, "How did Jim find you at the airport?" I thought, whew. Glad Jack gave her the short version. But communication is difficult, isn't it? It takes work. It takes constant work every day of our lives, probably until we go to be with Jesus. But it's fun work if you really commit yourself to it. Communication, as we want to talk about it this morning, is much more than talking. It's much more than listening. And it's much more than a combination of the two. Communication, as we want to talk about it, is really when my meaning meets your understanding across the bridge of words, tones, body, path, posture, all of the various methods that we use to communicate. When you understand me, and I understand your meaning, then we have true communication. But you know, friends, as I've even said that, there were probably 40 different conceptions of what I really just said. Many of you men were reading me one way, and many of you women were reading me another way. And let me illustrate what I mean. See, lots of times we find, and we try not to categorize men like this and women like this, because we're people, and I don't think it's necessary to categorize personally. But nevertheless, Jack and I find as we travel all over that there are probably 80%, I make up statistics, so don't believe anything I say, okay, but by 80%, at least, of men are much more like Jack is, objective, very factual, very to the point. Many women, and there again I'd say 80% or more, are much more subjective, feeling-oriented, so on. Now let's take these two people. And they've got 3 hours and they're going to go out for dinner. Now, both, they haven't talked for a month, really. And so both of their communications cup are empty. This is my gorgeous drawing here. This is an objective husband. And this is a subjective wife. And so they've got 3 hours to talk. eyeball to eyeball. Heaven. So the first hour, they get caught up with what's been happening at work, with their schedules, with the kids, with their friends. That's just great. By this hour, his cup is 50% full. Her cup is 5% full. Okay, so then they spend another hour and they're talking about the problems he's having with a client, what they want to do for next year's vacation, how they're doing with their financial planning. His cup is now 85% full, and her cup is about 15. The third hour, they're really getting down to the hardest of matters. They're talking about sharing what they learned in Bible study together and with their couple studies. They're talking about what they'd like to happen with the couples they're working with. They're talking about the dreams they have with their kids. Now, at this time, at the end of this 3 hours, his cup is 95% full. Her cup is maybe 25. They leave the restaurant, and he thinks, what a fantastic time of in-depth communication we've had. She's thinking, we've only just begun. He walks out, and he says, oh, man, we'll have to do this again next month. And she says, what about tomorrow? Now, you factual people don't understand what I've just said. You subjective people and feeling-oriented people have understood exactly what I've said. Why? Well, if this husband is an objective husband, he's talked about what he wants to talk about. And his cup is full. But if she is a feeling-oriented, subjective individual, they only talked about half of what she needed to talk about. She needed to talk about how she felt about the Bible study, what her emotions were about her job, what she's feeling as far as the kids are concerned, and she wanted to hear how he was feeling too. And this is why we have such different views when we talk about communication. See, when I said it was the meeting of meaning, when your understanding meets my understanding across the bridge, you women, a lot of you were thinking, yeah, if you'll only really hear my heart. And you men, many of you were thinking, yeah, if she'd only listen to what was really going on at work. Our expectations are different, aren't they? And that's the reason, often, if you took that little quiz that Jack was telling you about and the 12 areas of intimacy, we find that a great many more men will rate their communication in their marriage, and I'm assuming a good marriage. They will rate their communication, oh, we've got a 6.5 anyhow on a scale of 7. The wife is thinking, maybe 3. Now, why? It's this feeling kind of thing that I'm talking about. I laughed and cried at one book I recently read. The woman was talking about wanting, she says, since women are more into relationships, they spend more time simply sharing their lives with other people. A frequent goal for a woman is just to spend time with a friend or family member or perhaps someone in need. When women go out for lunch, they may have no other plans than just to share their lives with each other. When men go out to lunch, now I don't like this man-woman, like I said, but forgive me if you're the other way around, and you could be. That doesn't mean a thing, except you've just got to know that. When men go to lunch, it's usually to solve a business problem, get acquainted with a potential client, or just satisfy their hunger before or after playing golf or tennis. Their talk is usually about what they're doing, while women talk more about the relationships and what they're feeling. And her husband comes back with this. You say men don't share their lives with each other? Well, you're wrong, he says. We do a lot of that when we're together. For instance, when we play golf, we talk all the time. Nice putt. Hooking a little bit today, aren't you? Watch the rough on the next hole. Find your ball. Way to go. His idea of communication, of course, tongue in cheek. But her idea of communication. Sharing her life and her feelings. So maybe the first thing that you two need to do as you get together is just say, what's your definition of communication? What fills my cup? of communication. And of course, I am adamant on the fact that most women need other women friends, because there's no way that a man could talk, most men, I should say, could talk about feelings for 3 or 4 hours a day. It would just kill them. And while we women who are subjective have to be very understanding and lower our expectations many times, our unrealistic expectations, nevertheless, we could talk about feelings for 3 hours a day, some of us, and love it. So we need other friends, women friends, who can talk at that level too, but not excluding our husband, who God wants to be our best friend. Now, you can't know anyone unless you communicate with them. You can't love anything you don't know. Therefore, the depth of love existing between a husband and a wife will largely depend on the amount and depth of their communication. But of course, the thing of it is, many times what is lost when couples don't communicate is the desire. You may have been rebuffed or hurt, or there can be things that grow up around the walls of your heart until you simply stopped trying. And that's where we need so desperately to remember Ephesians 4:32, be kind to one another, be understanding, be as ready to forgive others as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. How much did God for Christ's sake forgive you? Everything. And how much are we to forgive? Everything. But oh, friends, we can't do that ourselves, can we? Sometimes we just have to go to each other and say, you know, there's so many high walls built up around my heart that I can't get over them. I can't get through them. And I need your help. Just to go to God and say, God, you level them. Help me. And let God tear those walls down. And let him give you the strength to forgive and start all over again. True communication means vulnerability. And boy, if you've been hurt time and time again, you're afraid to be vulnerable, aren't you? And that's why most of the time in many relationships, it's got to begin with forgiveness. God talks about communication in this way in Ephesians 4:15. He talks about not being immature children, but rather speaking the truth in love. We are to grow up in every way unto him who is the head, even Christ. If we could filter everything we say through that one little verse, and a companion verse in Proverbs 3:3 in the Living Bible says, never forget to be truthful and kind. Hold these virtues tightly. Write them deep within your heart. Truthful and kind. Love and truth. If we could filter everything through those two things, oh, my friends, we would speak the way God would have us speak. But it's difficult. There's so many things against us because communication is hard work. Probably one of the hardest things for us to learn is to be vulnerable enough to say, what do you mean? I don't understand what you're saying. This is the way I'm reading what you're saying. And probably some of the hardest words for husbands to recognize maybe is the fact that most wives don't say what they mean because they're speaking feelings. And so what comes out of their mouth is often not what is portrayed in their hearts. And therefore, the hardest thing is to say, what do you mean? And the hardest thing for a wife to do is to really open up on what she means. Because you see, for us especially, or any of you feeling-oriented people, first thing that comes into our minds is, well, he should know how I feel. After all these years, he should know how I feel. And if he doesn't know how I feel, then to tell him is defeating my purpose. How many of you wives have felt that way? How many of you husbands have felt that way? should know. Oh, friends, that's so unfair. Do you know that after almost 40 years of marriage, my husband still says to me, honey, I can't read your mind. Isn't that something? He can't read my mind. After 40 years, he ought to be able to, but he can't. And I need to recognize that. And so I'm not there yet, but I'm getting to the place where I can go over to him and say, honey, I'm really feeling ugly right now. What I really need is just a hug. And he gives me a hug. But you see, I used to think if I had to ask for it, I didn't want it. But way down deep, I did want it. That's the vulnerability. Now, husbands, we speak, husbands and wives, we are continually speaking encoded messages. Jack does better at this than I do because he is a factual person. He generally speaks more directly than I do. Because I'm a subjective person, I creep up on things. There's a reason for that. See, one of the reasons I creep up on things is because subjectively I'm so afraid that I might hurt you in something that I say, or that you might hurt me in something that you say, that I creep up on things. Now, I'm working on that. Part of communications is saying what you mean and meaning what you say. But Jack realizes after all these years that it's a hopeless case and I'm never going to quite make it. So he's constantly needing to ask, what do you mean? I'm asking him too. Now, even objective people speak encoded messages. For instance, Jack might come in and say, what time's dinner? Now, you would think that was a very obvious statement, wouldn't you? What time is dinner? Most of you would think, Jack's hungry, he wants supper served right away. But see, you would be wrong. What Jack is really saying is, do I have time to exercise before we eat? So he might be wanting dinner delayed, and here I am hurrying up trying to get it ready. Now, by this time, of course, I know that that's what he's really saying. But he's gotten to the place where he says, do I have time to exercise before dinner? Which is not a coded message. But we can't help it, most of us. We were driving down the street after spending a day with a dear couple, and all of a sudden she said, it's 5:00. Well, now, wasn't that interesting? All of us had watches. All of us knew it was 5:00. But we've been talking about this very thing, and so I kind of laughed and I says, okay, Jeannie, what are you really saying? Well, what Jeannie was really saying was, do we have time to go out and check on the kids before we go to dinner? She would have gone the whole evening if I hadn't have asked. And so we speak encoded messages, and we need to be constantly saying, what did you mean? But when we're asked that, my friends, we've got to be willing to open up. Now, friends, whenever your spouse asks you this question, do you love me? Please know they're not really asking, do you love me? They're asking much more than that. Just last November, we were to be presenting a marriage seminar here at the Glen. And I always get especially intimidated at the Glen. You know, people know me too well, and it's sort of awesome, and so I'm always feeling that way anyhow. But this time, I was especially intimidated. It was going to be a huge crowd, and that the week before that, we had had a women's staff conference here. And when I see people that I know and talk with people, I get really excited inside. And when I get hyper, I talk. And when I talk fast. And so all week long, I could feel myself getting more and more steamed up, you know, and going faster and faster. And then Friday evening came, and a nephew and his wife flew out from Detroit to be with us that weekend. And we sat around a table of 8 people not knowing one another. And, you know, I became Little Miss Hostess. And so I'm just asking people everything and yakking on the way I can do sometimes, and I felt my husband's hand on my knee. It was nonverbal communication for, simmer down, honey. So I tried. Well, that night went on. I kept getting more and more excited. 3 times the next day, my husband leaned over to me and said, simmer down, honey. I tried. That night we got home, very tired. And I put my arms around him and I said, do you love me? Now, what would you do if your whole life asked you that? Jack said, why, honey, of course I love you. Well, I knew he loves me. I said, I need that assurance right now. Now, as I give you this conversation, and I wrote it down verbatim because I realized, for one thing, we had done something right, but we don't always. But notice Jack's questions. He kept questioning, even though he was very tired. And I kept forcing myself to be vulnerable, because by this time I was feeling a little stupid. And I said, well, I need that assurance right now. And he said, well, for what reason? And I said, well, sometimes I guess I feel you love me, but maybe you don't like me at times. And he said, well, what has given you that impression? What have I done that would cause you to feel that way? And I said, well, several times today, you've told me to quiet down. And he said, but honey, you've been hyper all day. I was trying to help you. And I said, I think I know that, but when it's several times, I think you can't like me that way. And he said, but you need to accept the fact that the reason is I want to help you. And I sighed and I said, my head does, but my heart doesn't always. And he said, honey, I love you and I like you. And with that, we went to bed. But you see what happened here? For one thing, every single thing I said, I was sharing a feeling. And Jack had to understand that. Do you realize that every single thing he came back with was a fact? And I had to accept that. But the point was, we kept digging. We kept saying, really, in essence, what do you mean? What are you really saying? And oh, friends, that's what we've got to ask God for the ability to do. Now, people who are not feeling oriented, and I realize there are a lot of studies being made now on this left brain, right brain bit, and it actually has been discovered that most men's brains at 16 weeks in the womb are washed over with a solution that dissolves the connecting links between the right brain and the left brain. You've been brainwashed. You didn't know that, did you? What that does is you have a harder time with the feelings and the facts. And I think wives have to really realize that and be much more patient than we are. Because it could very well be a physiological reason. It's why you zero in on one area so much better sometimes than we do, but it's why we can jump back and forth sometimes better than you can. But whatever the reason, physiological or not, one of the commitments that must be made in marriage is the commitment to be a revealer of what's going on inside of you. Because if you can't be that revealer, it's going to destroy the intimacy and the closeness and the oneness that God wants for you and that your wife, most of your wives, desperately long for. One husband realized that he was this very factual person, and he realized that for a long time he was just saying, well, that's the way I am. I mean, she married me that way, and I can't change. And then he realized that his wife needed far more than that. And that was basically selfishness on his part and an unwillingness to change. And of course, Jack and I feel so strongly that one of the reasons for marriage, that God created marriage, is that iron will sharpen iron, as Proverbs 27:17 says. One person sharpens another. And the whole reason for marriage is change, to give us opportunities to become more like Jesus as we rub each other. And change. But as he prayed about this, he realized that his dogmatic approach to his own personality was sin. It was selfishness, and selfishness is sin. And so he confessed that sin to God and committed himself with God's help that he would learn to get in touch with his feelings and really be able to be vulnerable and open with his wife. Now, friends, that can take months. It's scary. Especially it's scary if you've been stabbed in the back a few times trying it. But oh, how necessary it is that we change, that we become revealers of our feelings. Now, one of the great problems as far as communication is concerned in our generation right here and now is the fact that we are simply too busy. And yet, this has to be a priority commitment in our lives. Jack and I had the privilege a year and a half or so ago of spending a day with Dr. Norm Wright as he was teaching. I think of Mr. Wright as being Mr. Marriage Counselor, kind of. He's written 50 books and talks about communication and so on. Fascinating time. And we watched him interview a couple who was going to be married. And the question that he kept asking them was, what makes you think you're going to make it? And they said, oh, we really love each other. We're really committed, you know, all the things that you and I would say. And he kept saying, hey, 90% of the couples that I get in my office ready to be divorced have said that. What makes you think you're going to make it? Well, he backed him into a corner until he didn't have anything else to say. And then he said, let me suggest two things that may help you make it for the long haul. And number one was, put into your budget time and money for some kind of a marriage retreat, seminar, whatever, every year. You know, Jack and I give them and we about fell off our chairs. And yet we can honestly say that giving this marriage seminar has done way more for our own marriage than anybody else's. Why? We're constantly reminding ourselves of things we ought to be keep working on. And it's tremendous. They said, put into your budget time and money for some kind of a marriage weekend every year. Secondly, he said, date. Don't ever stop dating. Not double dating, dating. Once a week if possible. Just the two of you to go out and have fun together, to talk about some things that you might not think to talk about, but date. Well, friends, what is that? Not being too busy. Not being too busy to make the priority commitment of your relationship with your spouse. Now, not only is there a commitment to be a concealer, commitment to be a revealer, rather, but there is a commitment that we must learn to work through conflict. The cardinal rule of conflict is to refuse to win. When you enter conflict with an I win, you lose kind of an attitude, my friends. You've both lost. But when you enter conflict with the idea of breaking through to better understanding of the situation, of understanding of one another, you have both won. So briefly, I'm going to give you 7 steps for conflict that will work on almost any conflict that is of a generic nature. Now, a generic nature means something that is coming up over and over and over again. You find that you're arguing or fighting about the same thing, and it doesn't seem to go away. That kind of a conflict. First of all, define the problem or issue of disagreement. Often as we define it for each other, we discover that we're not that far apart. In fact, I would say that the great majority of things that we think are conflicts are actually misunderstandings, that we haven't understood the meaning of the other person. And so as you define it, that may solve it right there. But define it so that you both can agree on it. Years ago, Jack traveled for much of the time. He was a regional director with the Navigators, and he would travel about 2 weeks out of every month. He would come home and be absolutely zonked. course, I had been home with our small daughter, the washing machine, the dog, and Dial a Prayer, and I was starved for adult communication. So, of course, I would meet him at the door with a great big hug and a kiss, throw my arms around him and say, "Honey, tell me all about that conference." And he would kind of grunt sometimes. Or he would tell me all about the conference in 5 minutes flat. Well, we found that this was a problem. It was a problem that was not going to go away because he was going to keep traveling and hopefully he was going to keep coming home. But I was always there wanting him to talk for 4 or 5 hours, and all he wanted to do was sit and stare at the ceiling. He'd been talking for the whole 2 weeks and counseling and ministering, and he just needed to collapse. So we sat down one day at his insistence and we defined the problems. Our needs were different. My need was for intimacy, immediate intimacy and talk. His was for distance, time to collect himself. Define the problem. Secondly, think through on how each of you contribute to the problem. I was contributing to it by my demands. He was contributing to it by the fact that he arrived home exhausted. And so we talked about how we were both contributing to that problem. Third, brainstorm and list all possible solutions. Now, this is where you get creative and fun, and it's no, don't either one of you say, "Oh, come on now, that's stupid." Not that kind of thing. Just have fun. Brainstorm on all possible solutions. Now, one fellow we know solved that same problem. He had 4 small children at home, and of course, they wanted his attention immediately when they got home. And he went on very long trips, so he spent a night in a motel before he came home, just to get a good night's sleep so he'd be fresh when he came home. That was one possible solution. We talked about that and figured that that wasn't very good on our budget. But possible solutions, what are they? And then you discuss each solution. And of course, in this, my friends, if one of you starts to cry and the other starts to get mad, you leave it, of course, and then come back. But set a time to come back when you both can talk about it in a non-emotional way. Then you agree on one solution to try. As we talked about it, Jack explained to me what he was doing in the 2 weeks that he was away, of course. And I said, "Well, you know, honey, you're right. I can wait for 24 hours before I make you tell me all about the conference." And he said, "You know, hon, if you would do that, if you just let me lay on the floor and stare at the ceiling or watch the boob tube or, you know, just do anything I wanted to for 24 hours, I'd promise that I'd take you out for lunch and tell you really everything that happened and answered all your questions." And I says, "Great, I can do that." And that's what we did. That was our solution. And it worked. Then agree on how each person will work toward that solution. I've already told you that. And lastly, set a time to review your progress. All right, 2 months from now, we'll sit down and see if this has really worked for us. It might be 2 weeks with the conflict that you're having. If it hasn't worked, you go back to number 3, brainstorm again, and start this process, agree on a different solution to try. We've seen this work with a lot of couples. And if you're both willing to give on this, it's a tremendous little tool in resolving conflict. Because we're always changing, my friends, this is an area in which it will take constant work to go deep. But the Bible says, speak the truth in love, and God will give you the ability to grow deep with one another. Thank you. I want to stand up a minute. I know you're tired, and Jack's going to come up. Stand up and stretch.
Sit down, yeah. Please sit down. We really don't have the time, but I'm going to tell you a story that I heard a year or two ago that is so typical of marriage and so funny that I love to tell it. So that's why I'm going to tell it, really, because I enjoy telling it. This couple, married couple, got up one Saturday morning, and before the day had even started, they had had a little fight with one another. Not a big deal, not a knockdown, drag-out thing, but they were kind of ticked off at one another. And she was getting dressed and asked him if he would help her with the zipper on the back of her dress, you know, back here. And he said, sure, I'll help you. He walks over and he went, zip, 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 and left it down and walked away. Well, she kind of stood there dumbfounded, not knowing what to do. And the day went on, and she had gone grocery shopping that afternoon and pulled in the driveway, got out of the car, got the groceries out, and then noticed that her husband was working on the other car. He was under the car working on it. And, of course, you know, when you're under a car working on it, this part of you from here up is under the car, and this part from here down is outside from under the car. Well, she looked the situation over. And saw her glorious opportunity, and she set the groceries down in the trunk of the car, walked over, reached down, took the zipper on his pants, and went zip, 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 and left them unzipped, of course. Picked up her groceries and triumphantly walked in the house. Oh, she walked into the kitchen, and there was her husband standing there. She said, what are you doing here? He said, what do you mean, what am I doing here? I live here. Well, who's that out under the car? Well, that's Joe next door. He's helping me work on the car. So they go rushing out the front door to find out how Joe is. And they look under the car, and he's out cold. When she had pulled that little zipper trick, he raised up, bumped his head on the bottom of the car, knocked himself out cold. That really happened. That's a true story. Oh, man. Such is married life, huh? It has a kind of a tragic ending. That's the funny part that's related to the marriage angle and how we better watch out about these little conflicts that we have with one another. Joe didn't recover. I mean, he didn't come to right away, and so they got a little concerned, and they dialed 911 and got the paramedics out. And so they came roaring out and got him on the gurney and the stretcher, and were kind of getting ready to load him in the ambulance, and they wanted to know, of course, how this happened. So they began to tell him how it happened, and the guys handling the stretcher got to laughing so hard, they dropped Joe. Yeah, this part's still true. And he fell off the stretcher and broke his shoulder. And he ended up suing the ambulance guys and his neighbors both. So, you know, that's the kind of a generation we live in nowadays. So be careful about these little, you know, it started with a zipper on the back of his wife's dress, huh? So we need to work our way through this matter of conflict. You know, I'm convinced that conflict resolution is one of the greatest deterrents, can be one of the greatest deterrents to a happy marriage, unless we learn how to handle it. And the thing that Carol and I have discovered is that many, many couples do not know how to handle conflict in a constructive, positive way. It eats away at the vitals of their marriage rather than them being able to turn it into something that is good and useful and helps them to understand one another better. And that's what it should do for us. And probably the basic root of that problem is pride. We're wired together that way. All of us are. None of us are excluded. We've got a deep streak of pride down within us. And sometimes, you know, our way is right. And we are bound and determined that is the way it has got to be. But listen to what the Bible says about that. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 5 and 6, it says, "Clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud." Now, I don't know whether you've ever stopped to think about it or not, but that's pretty stiff opposition. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may lift you up in due time." And then verse 7, of course, is one that we're all familiar with. "Cast all your cares or your anxieties on him, because he cares for you." We've got to work our way through, with God's help, this matter of pride, which so often gets in the way of our communication patterns with one another as a husband and a wife. Now, just in wrapping this thing up, let me mention a couple of nevers that are related to this matter of communication. Now, I put a little bit of a rider on this word never, because none of us are that consistent as human beings, that we never do something or we always do something. So you got to take this into consideration. And the fact also that this is something that Carol and I have determined between the two of us, that this is a no-no for us, these two things that I'm going to mention to you. You have to take these and weigh them yourself and determine whether this is applicable to you and whether it should be something that you ought to strive toward of being a no-no in your lives. First one is, never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. Now, that has to do with communication, huh? We're still on that subject. When Carol and I first got married, we had already, between the two of us, developed kind of a fun little way of kidding and joking with one another using sarcasm. And in the early days, the first few months, probably even the first year of our marriage, it was probably 95% harmless. We had no ulterior motives. There was no dig intended. It was purely humorous. We had a lot of fun with it. But as time went by, we got smarter, huh? We all get smarter by experience. And we both began to realize that this also was a good way of getting in a little negative dig without the other person really knowing for sure whether it was or not. And so we developed our skill in that. And that was the next progressive step in the matter of sarcastic humor between the two of us. Then the next progressive step was, can you top this type of thing? I would make a sarcastic statement to Carol, and then she felt she needed to come back at me with one, and then I had to top that one, and then she had to top me. And sometimes we'd go back and forth three or four times that way. And at that point, we began to realize that we were using it many times in more than just a humorous way. And we were hurting one another. But it was almost an addiction. Huh? You know what I mean? We were so trapped that we didn't know how to handle it, what to do about it. That was about the end of our second year of marriage. And that summer, I had been invited to come out to California and be a youth pastor in a church in Pasadena. We were going to seminary in those days down in Dallas, and so we went out to Pasadena and spent the summer, worked with this neat pastor and his wife. They were really a terrific couple. We got to know them very well over the course of the summer. We're with them a lot. And in the course of the first three or four weeks that we were there, had an opportunity to observe them to the extent that we really saw their lives in action. And they had a lot of fun with each other. They had a neat marriage going. They enjoyed one another. But we began to notice that even though they kidded around a lot, they joked with one another, they pulled little stunts on one another, they never used sarcasm. Never. We never heard them do it. So one night we were out to dinner with them. We asked them about this. We had observed this. And you got a neat marriage going, et cetera, et cetera. But we noticed you never used sarcasm. Of course, you know what we were asking. Well, they virtually repeated back to us our story, the The first 2 years they were married, they had fallen into this habit, and it grew and grew and grew, and finally it got to the place where they were hurting one another. And one night they realized it. They sat down and talked about it. They prayed about it together. They committed to one another that they were going to stop it. They got down on their knees and they prayed about it and asked God's forgiveness and His help in order to eliminate this habit from their lives. They even went so far as to commit to one another that they would call each other on it when it happened, because they had found themselves in the same boat we were in. We were sometimes unconscious of the fact that we were doing it. It would just come out and, you know, that would go by, and we weren't even aware that we had made a sarcastic statement. So they committed to one another that they would call each other on, not in front of other people, but afterwards, when they were, if it happened in front of other people, when they were on their way home, just the two of them, you know. Well, we went home that night, and we did the same thing they did. We talked it over. We'd touched on it before, but we really hadn't talked about it in depth. And we talked it over thoroughly, and we agreed that this was something that had to go. It had to be a no-no in our communication patterns. Then we got down on our knees, and we committed this to the Lord and asked Him for His help. And it probably took us the better part of 3 or 4 months to really get to the point where we were so sensitive to it that we were aware that we were doing it. Because sometimes we'd be out with a group of other couples, and, you know, you get the kidding and joking around, and pretty soon I'd make some dumb, sarcastic crack and not even be aware of it. And we'd be on our way home by ourselves, and Carol would say, "Hey, honey, you remember when I said this, and then you said, and then Joe said, and then you said to me?" And I had made a sarcastic statement, and I had to apologize. And she would do the same thing sometimes, and I'd call her on it. Not in front of other people, but by ourselves. It can be devastating. We have seen this sweep through whole families. And I don't know where you are. There's a lot more I could say on it, but examine it. Where are you on the matter of sarcasm? It can really be hurtful. Be kind to one another, the Scripture says, and sarcasm usually is not kind. Huh? Number two, never criticize, correct, or interrupt her or him in public. I can hear some of you groaning inwardly. What habits these can be. Huh? Never criticize, correct, or interrupt him or her in public. Now, I've got to say something here, because Carol and I, our problem is we're human beings. Huh? That's all of our problem. And so we blow it on these. Even though it's a no-no for us, we blow it once in a while. So you've got to realize we're telling you something that maybe applies to you and you need to work on, and we are working on. We have become very sensitive to it. But even we blow it. I blew it one time on this business of sarcasm. I blew it one time at a marriage seminar in front of the whole bunch. In front of the whole group. It's about 80 or 90 people. And I had to apologize. It came out, and it was one of those statements you make and you wish you could just reach out and grab it and take it back, because you know you did it the minute you said it. And I had to apologize to Carol. I had to apologize to the group. Of course, they all thought it was very humorous that the speaker who had just been talking about sarcasm did it. And the same thing with criticizing, correcting, or interrupting in public. You see, how does it make the other person look in front of other people when you do that, when you're constantly interrupting them, or you're correcting them, or you're criticizing them? How many times have you been in a social situation with a group of other couples, and it gets to be storytelling time? And, you know, this one guy, he's got a terrific story. I mean, it's got everything in it. It's got romance, mystery, intrigue. It's a terrific story, and he's a good storyteller. Reluctant storyteller, but a good storyteller. And his wife is giving him the elbow to tell his good story. And so finally, reluctantly, he gives in, and he begins to tell his story. And he really gets involved. And he gets so excited about it, and he puts in some stuff that he's never put in his story before. And she gives him the hand on the knee treatment, you know, "Honey, simmer down." And then he does, he simmers down, and then he leaves out a little section that he usually puts in, and then she says, well, honey, don't forget to tell him about so-and-so. Well, about the third time she interrupts him telling his story, you know, he kind of looks at her disgustedly and says, why don't you finish it? Or something like that. Now, how does that make you feel? And how do you feel about him? You know, if you're like I am, you want to kind of reach over and tie a gag on the wife's mouth and say, let him tell his story. Or it could be the other way around. Correcting or interrupting. We've got some friends here in Colorado Springs. We've known them for years, and I swear they never let one another finish a thought or an idea without interrupting the other person. And it's not always on the same track. It's, you know, 90 degrees the other way. And, of course, we know them. We've talked to them about it. It doesn't do any good. They still do it. But once in a while, you know, one of them is really saying something I want to hear. And so we know them well enough now, and I'll say, hey, let her finish. I want to hear what she's got to say. Or the other way around. I don't know whether you've got people you're close enough to do that, but we do with them. But because it makes the other person look bad in the eyes of people. When we correct or interrupt. How many times have you guys been in an automobile with a bunch of other husbands and they get talking about their wives? And what's it usually, what does the conversation usually deteriorate to? Criticism, sarcastic statements, the old bag, the ball and chain, you know. When that happens, and I'm in that kind of a group, it just kind of, it gets me inside because I feel sorry for those wives. Because it's, see, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks, the scripture says. And I wonder what kind of a relationship they have. You see, I want Carol to look good in the eyes of other people. In fact, I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. You probably never would have guessed that by now, but I am. There could be all kinds of reasons for that. Carol's a fantastic gal, wonderful wife, wonderful mother to our one daughter, Lynn. A great grandmother to our, no, not a great grandmother, a terrific grandmother. She's not a great grandmother yet. Terrific grandmother to our grandkids. She's a great cook. Fantastic cook. She's a writer. She ministers to women. She's got a heart for God. I mean, I could go on and on and on and list all kinds of virtues. But folks, those are not the primary reasons why I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. You want to know the real reason? It's because I love her. And because I love her, I want her to look good in the eyes of other people. And I know she feels the same way about me. And so we really work at this matter of criticism and correcting and interrupting one another in the front of other people. You know, but what do you do when your spouse really does blow it on some fact that they're conveying to somebody else and you happen to overhear? Example. Several years ago, the Navigators had a men's conference over Thanksgiving weekend up at Green Lake, Wisconsin. There were 987 men there. It started on Thursday night, Thanksgiving night, went all the way through noon on Sunday, and it was one of those rare weekends when the Spirit of God just moved into that weekend and into the hearts and lives of those guys, and there was such an electricity spiritually in the air. I was leading the singing at the Saturday night meeting, and I kept all the songs very soft and very slow, simply because there was just an electricity in the air. Well, when I got home, I took more than 5 minutes to tell Carol all about the weekend, and I went into detail and explained a lot of things to her that went on and what God had done and what had happened and how many were there and so forth. Well, a couple of weeks later, I overheard Carol telling a small group of ladies, just standing there talking informally, about this great conference the men had had up at Green Lake, Wisconsin over Thanksgiving weekend. And she, of course, one thing I've learned about writers is that they tend to exaggerate a great deal. Well, not a great deal, but some. And not only Carol, other writers that I know, they have a tendency to do the same thing and leave out what they don't feel is important and put in what may not really be there just to make it a good, better story. Well, I was listening to this, and Carol was waxing eloquent about this great men's conference. And, you know, there were just over 1,000 men there, and she went on like that. Well, now, you know, 1,000, just over 1,000 men, that really wasn't accurate. Now, see, I'm a very objective person, very factual. Actually, there were 987 men there, which is not just over 1,000, that's just under 1,000. Now, what do you do when you're faced with that kind of a situation? Well, I've come to the conclusion that the wisest thing to do is to take what I call the 20-year view. Okay? In other words, 20 years from now, will it really make any difference to those ladies whether it was just over 1,000 or just under 1,000? And after I think about that for some time and mull that over in my mind, 99.44% of the time, I come to the conclusion, no, it won't make any difference 20 years from now at all. So I keep my big mouth shut. Rather than going over there, interrupting the discussion, and saying, now, ladies, if you really want to know the straight scoop, huh? No. Never interrupt, correct, or criticize him or her in public. Because we love one another. Charlie Shedd, in his little book, Letters to Philip, wrote this short paragraph about this very thing. And it's kind of one of those statements that you put your right hand on the Bible, you raise your left hand, and you say, I solemnly swear. Okay, you know, like in court. Well, okay, I solemnly swear. Maybe you want to do this. Neither by day or by night will I ever cut you down in company. Not before my family, your family, our family. Not before friends, acquaintances, strangers. When you are with me or behind your back, never, by wisecrack or snide remark or in any manner, do I intend to be anything other than 100% loyal. That's the key, isn't it? Loyalty. It's backed up with love. We're going to have to quit, but I've got to read one other thing to you. About love. Doug was talking about love this morning, and we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Love is so essential to the marriage relationship. It's not everything. That's why we entitled our book, Marriage Takes More Than Love. But it does take love, the kind of love that is talked about in 1 Corinthians 13, the kind of love that's talked about over in 1 John 3:18, my little children, let us not love just in speech and in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Actions. We have to show our love by our actions. I came across this little article some time ago. And while it's not talking about marriage, it's talking about the kind of love that needs to be cranked into marriage. It's the kind of love that we've had to crank into our marriage, I particularly, in order for it to be as rewarding and fulfilling as it had been. And it's been a fabulous 40 years for us. This is entitled, Always Keep Telling Me. We had always been a very proper family, never very demonstrative. We seldom hugged and almost never kissed. We men shook hands. Father taught us to give a firm, manly handshake and to look the other fellow in the eye when you're doing it. But as my father grew old, I saw that he became far less inhibited. He was not ashamed when others saw him weep. He finally found the freedom to take my mother's hand and kiss her in front of the children and grandchildren, something we'd never seen him do in his younger years. Dad even found the freedom to put his arm around a woman other than the wife he loved. Some may have equated his freedom with senility. I attributed it to maturity. Dad once told me that the older he became, the more he realized he had confused spontaneity and impropriety. Life is too short not to show your genuine feelings of affection. Now, if you knew me and my background and my dad, you would understand why this story touches my heart. But I know there's some of you in the room that were in the same boat I was in. He goes on, as I watched my father become free and felt my own love for him growing, I too longed to express my affection in a more meaningful way. Yet every time I was with him, and it came time to say goodbye, instead of bending to kiss him, I always stuck out my hand. Even the words, I love you, caught in my throat. I wanted to say them, but I was afraid to try. Finally, I could stand it no longer. My sophistication and twisted concepts of the masculinity were choking me. One Saturday afternoon, I made a special trip to my parents' home 35 miles away. Walking into my father's study, I found him in his wheelchair, working on his ledger. I've come for one purpose, I said. I want to tell you something, and I want to do something. Suddenly, I felt like a fool. I was 46 years old, he was 86. But I'd come this far, and I was not going to back out now. I love you, I said, choking up. Is that what you came to tell me? He asked gently, putting his pen on the desk and placing his hands in his lap. You didn't have to come all the way down here to tell me that. But I'm sure glad you did. I've wanted to say those words for years, I said. I find it easy to write them on paper, but it's been difficult for me to say them. Perhaps I needed to say it more for me than for you. His face grew pensive, and he nodded slowly. There's something else, I said. He did not look up, but continued to stare straight ahead, nodding slowly. I bent and kissed him, first on one cheek, then on the other, and then on the top of his bald forehead. He reached up, took my arms in his strong hands, and pulled me down to him so he could put his arms around my neck. For long moments, we remained in that awkward position. Finally, he released me, and I straightened. There were tears in his eyes, and his lips quivered as he spoke. He said, "My father died when I was a young man back in Indiana. Shortly after, I left home to go to college, teach school, and then go to France in World War I. After the war, I moved to Florida. I never returned home except for occasional visits to see my mother. When she grew old, I invited her to come and live with us." He paused, and his face broke into a grin. She said, "No, I'll stay right here in this house, but I love you for asking me to come and live with you. Even though I'll never do it, I hope you keep on asking me until the day I die." Looking up at me, my father said, "I know you love me, but I hope you keep right on telling me until the day I die." Something broke loose in me that Saturday afternoon, something that had been knotted up for years. As I drove home, I felt my spirit soar. At last, I was free too. I think that's what 1 John 3:18 means. Little children, let us not love just in words and in speech, but in deed and in truth. And there's some of us who need to learn how to do that, to show our affection and our love by a hug, by a kiss on the cheek. I had to learn how to do that. My wife was my coach. She taught me how. I've never regretted it. And as Doug was talking about love this morning, you know, how can we love God with our whole hearts and yet have more love left over for some other people? Somebody put it this way. I love this. Be a spendthrift in love. Love is the one treasure that multiplies by division. It is the one gift that grows bigger the more you take from it. It's the one business in which it pays to be an absolute spendthrift. Give it away. Throw it away. Splash it over. Empty your pocket. Shake the basket. Turn the glass upside down. And tomorrow, you will have more than ever before. That's the way love is. You give it away. Throw it away. Spend it on people. Spend it on your family. And you'll find that you got more than ever to give away. And it especially needs to be directed toward our spouses. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word, for the great truths that we find contained in it. We thank you for the practical aspects of your word that relate so directly to our lives together as a husband and a wife. And I pray that you would help us as we delve into the scriptures, that we would be sensitized by the Spirit of God to see those things that you want us to respond to as a husband, as a wife, in order to be a better husband, to be a better wife. Help us to learn from you, from the Spirit of God speaking to us through the Word, and to learn from one another, and to grow in the knowledge and wisdom of Jesus Christ, and to grow as people who are more Christ-like day by day. These things we ask in His name. Amen.